Blog Talk Radio.
Blessed, blessed souls, but we can win when we stop the bloodshed in the world, physically, spiritually. Baruch Hashem, blessed is the Almighty Creator. Blessings and greens, greens, blessings, blessed souls. You're now tuned into Blog Talk Radio, and this is Soul Talk. Used to call ourselves Soul Class, but anyway, humbly assert with the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. This is Soul Talk, presentation number 794, Proverbs, Teachings to Access Wisdom and Righteousness, number 17. Blessed is our eternal creator. Shalom, peace. And I mean shalom gadol, great peace and bracha, blessing upon the entire human family condition. With the creator's help, our next broadcast is taking place right now. October 15th is now 11:01 a.m. live Eastern Standard Time from Turtle Island equals AKA equals the USA equals Unified Soul Actualization. An essential topic for discussion will be sharing the written oral Torah traditions regarding King Solomon's Proverbs, one of the most powerful teachings from Israelite Tanakh, Torah, prophets, holy writings. Our call-in number, if you want to make the show a little bit more organic, 563-999-3688. That's 563-999-3688. Meanwhile, may the eternal creator bless and protect you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. The tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, Children of Israel, collaborating with the children of Noah to eliminate hatred, jealousy, and competition from this blessed world. Galif Galifa, which is an ancient Kabbalistic technique, the Almighty engraving the engraving for the plans for the creation, the written oral Torah, tradition of Israel. And with that being said, we're segueing out of a song by the Maccabees, a group of fine young men who did a rendition of Matthew's One Day Where We Don't Want Any More War. And joining us this morning is our, thank God, is our Rambam teacher, student advocate, and disseminator of the teachings of the Nesher Godel, the Great Eagle, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Don. How are you?
Baruch Hashem, you know, there's a teaching in the Zohar that one part of my heart is crying and one part of my heart is rejoicing. And I suggest that people, they can go look this teaching up. What is the implication of one part of the heart is rejoicing, one part of the heart is crying? I mean, we have a situation which is pitifully painful in the Middle East. But it's not just that. It's, you know, sometimes, Dennis, I look at the world and I say, whatever's going around the world, it's just a template of what could take place in another part of the world, whether it be for the positive or negative. And unfortunately, I think since the Clinton-Trump presidential election until now, so we're talking about a good 7-8 years, that just human dialogue has become so much more abrupt and so much more polemic. And I think really to start to change the template of human condition over here on the four corners of the globe, we're going to have to start speaking more civil to each other. And I have a story from the Baal Shem Tov to follow up whatever your thoughts, questions, and concerns about what I just talked about. So, Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, I never heard of so many people talk about peace. And what do? They accuse. Rather than have a dialogue, they accuse. And that's why they think that's part of the dialogue. While in effect, it's what you have in common, not what makes the differences. So if you emphasize the difference, you never find peace because you have nothing in common. We need that commonality, even in a dialogue. And even most religions profess that they're interested in peace. But there comes a time when they put their religion aside and they decide to emphasize the differences. And we get back into accusatory, well, accusing somebody doesn't prove or disprove anything. Either you love God or you don't. You cannot say you're a person of peace and then accuse everybody else of doing the opposite. We need commonality. And without that commonality, we'll never have a dialogue and we'll always think of what is the real difference. But it doesn't matter because do you love God or not? You cannot go halfway. You cannot go three quarters of the way. You must profess what you believe in. You cannot say, I'm your neighbor, but I want to do harm to you. Doesn't make sense. Why would you have a neighbor that doesn't want to have commonality, have a dialogue? If you keep accusing everybody around you, you're not going to have peace. So be it.
Thank you, Dennis. I'd like to share a story before I just mentioned Dennis before the program. I want to tell a very pungent story about how important our human speech is, because that really, of course, the animal kingdom has its own level of speech. Even in the plant kingdom, I mean, there's some sort of communication amongst trees on how their roots spread out underground. You know, King Solomon, who was not Dr. Doolittle, had the wisdom how to speak to animals. So they do communicate because they're from the angelic structure of the creation as opposed to human beings who are designed with the divine lineage, our human intellect. And so we can process things on a much more practical and even theological or philosophical level. It doesn't necessarily lead to action, but eventually it leads to something positive. So what happened was about 3 weeks ago, I was in Israel, the Holy Land, and I had impacted wax in both my ears. It was really bad. I mean, it got to the point where, you know, like I felt like I needed hearing aids. So I, by mistake, had not taken care of this while I was still in the States before, and I went on my almost two-week trip there. And I wound up at an urgent care center in Israel. And those of you who live in big cities, like, say, New York City, we take for granted that urgent care is all around us, like the local McDonald's or, you know, bar, whatever you want to call it. And I went in to be checked out, and a doctor examined me, took my vitals. And then a nurse extracted the wax. So in the end, he just reviewed with me some of my vitals and what his concerns were. I said, thank you, doctor. I can take care of these matters back in America. And for some reason, it just flew into my mind. I said, doctor, I'm just curious, where did you go to medical school? And he said he went to school in Egypt. So I said to him, and I didn't say it with any zeal. I said, well, his name is Dr. Tzarok. Now, in Hebrew, there's a word tzarich, which means need. But Tzarok, I never heard before. I thought he was a Sephardic person of Sephardic Jewish ancestry. So he looked at me very soberly and said, no, I had no anti-Semitism, I'm an Arab. So at that point, I knew I was in a little bit of a quandary because maybe I was instilling into his mind some sort of ill will. So I took his hand and said, Dr. Tzarok, I want to tell you something. You and I are descendants of Abraham or Avraham or Ibrahim, as you probably is most familiar in calling it. That's the Arabic, you know, pronunciation of the name Abraham or Avraham. He said, we are his descendants. We have to make peace together. He looked at me soberly, said, yes. And that was the conclusion of it. And I wished him well. And he walked away and I walked away. And unfortunately, we've had the opposite of peace between two peoples who have some sort of DNA connection going way, 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 way back. And it's just a shame. But I want to now share a story And I'll ask Dennis after my story from the Baal Shem Tov to chime in on that and our Baal Shem Tov story. I read this on this yesterday, the Shabbos, the Holy Shabbos, Holy Sabbath. And it talked about actually two Jewish people, and they got into some sort of verbal altercation. And what happened was one of the guys told him he was going to tear him into pieces like a fish. He was going to tear him like a fish into pieces. That's pretty rough language. I mean, you know, in Torah, by Torah standards, it's totally forbidden. I mean, in American law, probably he could be, you know, that's a reason to call 911 and the police investigate the situation. But what happened was, I believe it was after that Shabbos, that Sabbath, that this happened. This is something that happened 200 and, let's see, the Baal Shem Tov passed on in 1760. So we're talking about something that took place more than 264 years ago. So the Baal Shem Tov gathered his students around him, and he asked everyone to put their hands on their friend's shoulders, the one closest to him. And the Baal Shem Tov put his two hands on two of the closest students to him. And somehow, I don't know how he did it, but the Baal Shem Tov was able to pictorialize within the minds of all of his followers that scene where one Jew was telling another Jew, "I'm going to tear you like to pieces like a fish." And all of them became extremely frightened, and they ran away. So the instruction there is that, you know, we underestimate the power of our speech. We underestimate the power of our intent when it's going in the negative direction. Because even though on the physical plane, that one person did never tore the other person to a fish, but he wanted to in his thought process and in his speech process. So right now, with all the hateful speech flying all around the world, what I'm asking our Blessed Soul listening family, and by the way, I just want to mention before we turn to Dennis for some feedback, is that right now we have, in terms of, though we've been off for about 5 weeks because of my being busy and being in Israel, that 83.57% of our listening audience is in the U.S., followed by 3.57% from Canada, 2.86 from Australia, Jamaica, I'm still happy to say is part of the top five at 2.86, and the little state of Israel, modern Israel, is at 2.14%. So Dennis, two things. Number one, your reaction to my encounter with this Arab doctor who is very nice, and I'm sure he's getting a lot of blessings because he's treating a lot of people over there in Modi'in, which is happened to be the ancient area where the Maccabees from the Hanukkah story hailed from. And also then this story about, you know, the damages negative speech can have on people even though we don't perceive it.
Well done.
Dennis?
I got to go back to Maimonides on this one because he preached that we must moderate our feelings. If we don't moderate our feelings, they get out of control, and you have all sorts of problems, and people don't know how to get back to normalization. They don't know how to conquer their anger because they let their anger go. There's no moderation. Without the moderation of human feelings, you're looking for problems, troubles, and they'll just bubble up to the top and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
So how far can your anger go? Are you a human of peace? Do you care about other people? If you do, does that mean you have to control your anger? We all will feel irritated at things, but don't let that irritation take over all of your bad feelings and push the good feelings away because you're angry. The world doesn't stop because you're angry. It continues. But if you have friends of any type, you can only keep them if you can control your anger, or else you will lash out and you will think your anger is more important than someone else's peace. That is the problem of the human condition. And Maimonides kept trying to emphasize that if you can't control your emotions, are you ready for the outcome? The outcome being that you are not in control anymore. And if you say things that you really wouldn't say under normal conditions. Is it too late to pull them back? Can you reverse your words? We know people can speak and speak and speak, but how do you take back your words that maybe you didn't really mean, but you said them in a moment of loose anger? We must control our emotions. Our emotions is our weakness as well as the goodness.
Yeah. Thank you. Now, this story about the Baal Shem Tov, I hope I was clear, that he showed to them how damaging human speech can be when one is wishing ill will on the other. Your take on these matters. How the potential for damage didn't manifest into a physical tearing up, but what he pictorialized for his chassidim, his followers, was it's on the spiritual realm there is damage being done. Any comments or thoughts on that?
There's always damage that's going to be done. Humans don't know how to treat each other as to where the breaking point is. In other words, how much anger can you accept from another person that you must now argue in kind, and you must show your anger. In other words, it's very hard for somebody to say, I'm a peaceful person, when everybody around is exercising their anger. Because what measurement are you using? What is happening at the moment? If you don't think of what's going to happen in the future, that means you don't care about the moment you're in. We must remind people, everybody, do you believe in? But to vent your anger is not a good thing. You will do things that you really have no control over, and you will not be able to reverse it or take it back. So we must be careful of what words we use, because it isn't a question of hurting other people's feelings. You're threatening the way of their life. You don't know how deep the words can hurt other people. But if you show so much emotion, I'm sorry, you're not moderating your feelings. If you're not moderating your feelings, there's no dialogue. You become an accusatory person, and you think that explains everything because you accuse somebody of doing something bad. Nobody is perfect. So it's a question of accepting the ills and the problems that exist. We can absorb them, but if we don't address them, we can't have a dialogue.
Very good. I'd like to now turn to a verse in chapter 6, verse 11, which, in fact, uses the word Hamas. Now, I just want to preface that with saying that if you go into the internet or cyberspace or a dictionary, if it's a modern dictionary, because Hamas is an organization that's less than 40 years old, from the Arabic cultural or intellectual perspective, Hamas means zeal, strength, and bravery. However, let us point out that, of course, they're entitled to call it whatever they want, because that's, I'm against imposing my cultural standards on another culture or faith or religion, whatever you want to call it. But from the ancient Hebrew, which preceded, when this language was used of Hamas, was used in the 6th chapter, the 11th verse, had nothing to do with Jews or Arabs or Christians or whatever denominations were, but they weren't formally called that back then. It was basically there were people serving idols or people not serving idols. So there's a verse that mentions the earth was, and this is chapter 6, verse 11, because you can check out on your Bible, you have a Torah, you can see it in the Hebrew as well. The earth was corrupt before God, and the land was filled with crime. So the word for crime in Hebrew, but it also can mean violence, is called Hamas, or you would say, more in Anglo-Saxon, Hamas. So what is this Hamas? What is this crime? What is this sense of violence? So from the oral Torah tradition, it said that in the Hebrew that before them, meaning the earth is full of crime from their faces. What does that mean? meaning the leaders or the aristocrats, according to an explanation called Pnei Ha'edah, the face of the congregation, they were looking the other way when crimes were taking place. And we'll be turning to what type of crimes were being committed at them. And it was the leaders of the community who would not correct others. And according to the oral tradition, the leaders in the time of Noah were worse than anyone else. And so therefore, if they were the leaders of the community and they were doing crimes, others followed them. And therefore, it's brought down that if the earth was full of crime in the time of Noah, it was the fault of the leadership. And I'll give anyone a scenario of how this crime was very subtle. So in those days, you know, basically it was an agrarian society. There was no big cities at that time, as far as I know. There wasn't any high-tech cities. There wasn't any green cities. There was just people farming or living as Bedouins, forest people, mountain people. So a farmer would bring a load of fruit to the market to sell it and make a small profit. So the corrupt citizens would find ways to eat the fruit without paying. Each one would behave as a customer. While he and the farmer were haggling over the price, he would start to nibble on the fruit. Once he ate his fill, he would find some excuse for not buying anything. He would complain that the fruit was not good or the price was not right. And even if he paid, he would do so with a worthless or counterfeit money. And this was an extremely common practice in those days. Again, we're talking about the days before Noah. If the farmer tried to collect for the fruit that had been eaten, the other would reply, "I was only tasting your merchandise to see if it was good. Everyone does it." If the case was brought before the courts, this was considered a valid defense. The wheels of justice were set against the common man, allowing him to be robbed legally. Another major problem of that generation was idolatry. At first, idolatry was a private affair, and people were they had some hesitations about it. But as time went by, hesitancy went away, and idols were worshipped publicly and became totally acceptable. One more thing to point out in the oral Torah tradition, in those days, again, before the flood of Noah, that wheat grew as large as a tree. And the Almighty, in the oral Torah tradition, you know, through the Ruach HaKodesh, the divine inspiration of the sages of Israel, that these people are not even aware of the good I do for them. The stalks of grain are so tall and thick, it will be impossible to harvest them. But I send a strong wind to blow down the kernels in which they can be easily gathered. And guys, I liken that to modern society. You and I don't have to go and hunt an animal if we want to eat it. We don't have to go out to the farm to cut down our stalks of wheat. It's all prepared for us. And how much are we appreciative of this? But again, I want to go back to the beginning of this sequence here. It's that the leaders were corrupt. So how can we be surprised if the followers of the leaders were also corrupt? Take on these matters?
Well, we humans tend to follow other humans because we believe there's safety in numbers. Or does that create an excuse? If they're doing it, I should do it? We must question ourselves as to what our motives are. And to do that, you must understand what nature is about. Nature has a purpose. God has given everything in nature a purpose. The question is, the humans that inhabit the earth, do they have a purpose? Do they know what their purpose is? Do they have a concept of the standards they should be following so they can attain some type of purpose? Now, true, you always get some human will say, "I want to take a shortcut. If I can get away with it, so much the better." Yes, well, do you have standards if you're going to take shortcuts? If you do, that's like saying, "Well, they'll have allowances for minor lies. Little white lies are fine." But when we get to the big ones, can we tell the difference between a big bad lie and a good little lie? Anyway, it's the world of lies. If you want to rely on lies, that doesn't give you a purpose. That's telling you how to avoid standards. No. What happens is Maimonides preached this over and over and over, and I guess a lot of people didn't understand what he was really talking about when he said moderate. In other words, you must constantly examine your own purpose, just in nature. God has given nature all a purpose. no interference with nature, but the humans have options. You have to make decisions. Do you want to follow standards? Do you want peace? Do you want to argue? Do you want differences to show up? Are the differences more important than your purpose? You must be able to plot you are going in the future so that you don't run into any of the pitfalls. The pitfalls are always there. Always there. You will get no peace if you pretend that there is no problems. Problems are part of life and we must overcome them. But to do that, we have to control what we think, our purpose, and what we want to be or what effect we want to have. If you want friends, you can't be a person who argues all the time. There's no real result in arguing. It's the people who are not arguing are saying, are you wasting my time? Why is it so important to you? We must revisit our purpose from time to time. And a lot of people who say they're religious sometimes forget they are human, and humans are not perfect. So we must be always on guard against those people who are trying to break standards or run around it. Get by. Have shortcuts. I'll steal a little here, a little there. That's not breaking the bank of anybody. No, it's those little things that start building up. And once you accept those little things that go against the standard, you're ready to think of bigger things that you can use as an excuse. We cannot go through life just with excuses. We must remember our purpose and why we put on the earth here. We always have nature to look at and say, wait a minute, nature is somewhat peaceful. It gets violent from time to time, but it doesn't get extreme. We are extreme when we lose our senses and feelings and temperament. Little things like that start building up. Since we're imperfect, sometimes that buildup will cause us to think a different way. And that is different than what we originally started out with since we were born. We weren't born angry. We weren't born arguing. We had to listen, absorb it, and understand. But the main part is to control it. And like Mayamati said, moderation is the key to living. If you can't moderate, then what are you doing? Something that's absurd.
Thank you, Dennis. So I'd like to turn to one more verse, this time from King David's Psalms, chapter 11, verse 5. It starts off, it goes basically from one extreme to the other in terms of personality types or individuals who dwell upon this earth. It goes like this, chapter 11, verse 5. The Almighty examines the righteous one, but the wicked and lover of violence he despises. We'll get in a minute to the lover of violence he despises, but let's first examine, as King David is asking us to try to get some sort of insight into what the Almighty is examining the righteous person about. In the oral Torah traditions that King David told his enemies, I am afflicted and pursued by you, and you exult in saying, God has abandoned him, meaning King David, or David before he was king. He composed some of the Psalms before he was King David and after, of course. But this is not the case, for the way of the Creator is to afflict and test the righteous, but not the wicked. This made me liken to the flax maker, who when he knows that the flax is strong and durable, he beats it vigorously. And Rashi concludes in this explanation, but when it is not strong, he refrains from beating it, lest it is shred and fall apart. So the Almighty tests a righteous person in order to display his genuine goodness in the entire world, in order to cleanse him or her of their sins, a few sins of that, for that matter. So this is what we're in a situation right now. We're all being tested one way or another. If we're paying attention to the media, if we're not paying attention to the media, if we're aware of what's going on in the Middle East, or in the Ukraine, or I don't know, wherever there's, you know, clashes in Africa, or somewhere deep in China, or I don't know, in the streets of New York, in the streets of the cities of this country. It is a golden opportunity for us to understand, despite the very, very difficult circumstances the whole world is in right now, because anyone who thinks this is not involving the whole world is foolish, because it's a test of two different types of mentalities. And I'll let you define for them what those two are. So the actual purpose of a test is not only to bring the righteousness of a good man to the attention of the world, but also bring it to the attention of the good man himself. For instance, in Noah, I mean, he knew he did not want to fall in the ways of the wicked of his generation, but he wasn't really exalted. In fact, he was verbally attacked, and they had planned to actually break down the ark and kill him and his family. The Almighty intervened, and the flood came about. So in the Gate of Reward by Nachmanides, it mentions that the Almighty tests the righteous in order to extract the latent potential powers of faith from their inner selves and bring it forth to fruition. The Almighty knows what strength any person possesses, but he wants this righteous soul, this righteous person, to come to know for themselves. So there's something about being elevated by self-knowledge, Dennis. Maybe talk about that and your take on the fact that the test that the righteous have to endure is a golden opportunity to increase in goodness in the world, to draw attention not only to the fact that they are good, but the fact that goodness is the way that we should be going in this world, to promote a world of goodness, kindness, and fellowshipping.
It's unfortunate that we don't reward the goodness in people. We're more impressed by where they stand in terms of conflict. Yet, everybody knows that we're should know that we're imperfect, and we got to control our emotions. But we don't give out prizes for people who practice good. We notice the people who are fighting, arguing, causing havoc all over the place. There's always something going crazy in the world. Conflict is always bubbling up from someplace. If there was no conflict, a lot of people would have to be good. And that's not a bad thing. But some people feel like they have to join in, follow other humans. And if this really bothers them, it bothers me. Wow, that's sharing conflict. Wrong way to go, but there's a lot of people that do that. They say, well, it's not their fault. We come up with excuses after excuse after excuse. If you want to do good, you will. If you don't, you should be aware that you made the choice not to be good. But that's your
right.
Choice. It's highly personal. And remember that the standards that are set basically by your parents when you were born, called right and wrong, stay with you for the rest of your life. You cannot all of a sudden change those standards. If you change those standards, then you are going to change the purpose as to why God put you on the earth. We cannot deviate basic goodness. But there are people that will come up with excuses and say, well, too much of something is no good. Well, what are you moderating, the bad or the good? We must remember that we must stay in control, and you must have purpose to what you're doing. If you give in to the devil or a little bit of the devil, are you doing a disservice to yourself and your fellow man? We must all be aware as to why we were put on the planet. But you cannot come out and say, well, we'll allow shortcuts under this, but not under that way. Well, once you start making these excuses, it never ends. One excuse begets two or three others, and they multiply. All of a sudden, do we still have control if we allow shortcuts? If you want to be good, you will be good. What you must think good and you must worry about are your neighbor's good. Why? Because you can end up following the wrong thing and believe in what they're doing is what you should do, when in effect you should be questioning what they're doing. So this is a constant struggle, a constant fight. Yes, Don, it's a test. It's a test of your inner being. Can you be true to God? Can you be true to yourself? Can you be true to your fellow man? We must keep those purposes in front, and we cannot take our eyes off the ball in the game. The ball is you, and you are the center of those decisions.
Thank you, Dennis. Now we're going to go to the second half of this verse. In Psalms, he begins with saying, "The Lord examines the righteous, but the wicked over violence he despises." What are we talking about here? Again, I just want to point out where it says the lover of violence, the word for violence here is Hamas. Now again, and we mentioned before that in the book of Genesis, in the story of Noah, it's referring to crime, but here it's referring to violence. It can mean violence or crime. And again, the Arabic or Islamic perception is one of religious zeal. Anyway, people have to choose what form or definition they feel most comfortable with in terms of Hamas. So the Rashi, a primary commentator on oral Torah traditions, elucidating on what is really embedded within the written Torah tradition, and again, these are prophetic teachings of Psalms. The Almighty despises the wicked, and he conceals their well-deserved punishment for the eternal world. And then he will rain it down upon them in Gehenna. Meaning it could be actually quite good for a person doing evil in this world, it comes to our surprise and sometimes our disappointment. Why does such a person flourish? But actually it's quite the contrary to think that is a sign of God's favor. Quite the contrary. The person is not worthy of divine discipline because the person wouldn't accept it and further rebel. And therefore, this person is in a real quandary. One example of this, and Rambam talks about this in his Shmona Prochem, the Mishnah, the seven chapters to elucidating on teachings of Mishnah, which is our forms of oral Torah tradition, is that once Pharaoh, the ancient Egyptian king, and it's mentioned in the book of Exodus, once he said, let us deal wisely with the Hebrews, the Israelites, we know as Jews today, that he lost his freedom of choice in terms of how to deal with them. Now, the Rambam raises the point that while Paro lost his freedom of choice, it wasn't necessarily a decree upon the entire Egyptian people to also lose their freedom of choice. And basically, there, you know, you read about the 10 plagues upon the entirety of the Egyptian people was based on the fact that they went along with Paro or Pharaoh's plan, which is a problem. But the Rambam says each one of them had the ability to, in fact, choose right. And in fact, in the end, at the end of the day, with the going out of Egypt, you know, the army was decimated at the Red Sea, the splitting of the Red Sea, but there were still Egyptians who had survived. And perhaps it could have been in the merit of the fact that at the time of the leaving of the Israelites from Egypt, Moses, the mighty leader prophet, had gained their respect and awe, and they saw who he was representing, something other than the various gods of ancient Egypt, the various forms of idolatry. So they survived. In fact, several generations later, one of the wives that King Solomon married was a daughter of Egypt. So we see that it wasn't just a total annihilation of the Egyptian people. It was those who chose to go in a less confrontational, oppressive fashion, they were spared, and they actually continued on as a civilization for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And then the time of Sennacherib, who was a Greek-Assyrian king, he dispersed the nations. He mixed up all the nations. In fact, he's the one who dispersed the 10 tribes of Israel out of Israel. But Dennis, you know, there is a famous teaching by a rabbi, Rabbi Manus Friedman, why do bad things happen to good people. So some people might ask the question, why do good things happen to bad people? So my first question is, you know, it's really not us to decide who's bad and who's good, because the bad person of yesterday could become the righteous person of today through the Torah-mandated teaching of tshuva, of repentance, returning to God. So your take on these matters, that it's a real should feel mercy upon the person who's going in a bad way, because they're so caught up in it, even if they were to be, according to Rashi, even if they would be disciplined, they wouldn't see it as a discipline. It's just something, just us to ignite further their evil deeds.
Well, we have a righteous God who practices good things. People have a hard time following that. But then again, we're imperfect, so therefore, that means we can make mistakes. We are prone to make the wrong choices. We are prone to accept little bits of evil, not a lot. We can take it. We can absorb it. But are you being true to yourself when you do that? We must remember that God is always forgiving. He will always forgive us. But that means you have to understand evil from good. You must understand that if you accept a little bit of evil, does that mean you're diminishing your good? Of course it does. Every time you make a choice, every time you make a choice to accept a little hunk of evil that may be labeled, don't do this. We accept it, we do it. Can we reverse the process? We can with God. God is always open and forgiving. He never closes his shop. God's corporation is always working. Are you? Do you give up on God? Can you give up on God? God made us. God wants us back in heaven. He wants us back, but he wants us to understand the difference between good and evil. Yes, we can make mistakes. We're not perfect. But that doesn't mean God will reject us in any way, shape, or form. God, you must believe, is always open if you want to be open. Open means that you don't have any obstacles in your way. If you broke your fingernail, does that change the way you think between good and bad? Some people think sometimes that's related. Oh, I'm going through a phase. I'm going through bad times. Sometimes people don't realize how good they are as opposed to how bad they are. But God is always open. He's open for you to realize the difference of what your purpose is and what you intend to do.
Dennis, we're going to move on, and Blitzels, we're going to move on to the essential topic for discussion. We have about 15 more minutes, so I think juicy discussion going on. And this is chapter 2 of Proverbs. It goes like this, chapter 2, verse 1. My son, which is all referring to my daughter. This is not just referring talking to men, because women as well as men have responsibilities to keep certain precepts from the Torah, whether they be of the children of Israel or children of Noah. King Solomon, again, is writing a prophetic teaching. So it's not just him saying, my son, meaning, or my child. He's echoing, he's a loudspeaker for the Creator, reflecting back out to the creation, my son, or I'll just add my daughter, if you accept my words and treasure my commandments. So Solomon says, as a messenger of the Almighty, you will be considered my son if you accept my commandments in your heart. Now, what if a person doesn't accept the commandments in their heart, or accept the commandments simply? Well, they're still a child of the Almighty. No one says not, but it's a type of rebellion, whether it be conscious or subconscious. And to treasure my commandments, to guard them from being forgotten, meaning if we see, like for instance, the Torah-mandated mitzvah, commandment, edict, do not murder. So we should never forget that. So it's a pretty powerful instruction commandment. It's just not because it makes sense to our human teeny tiny minds. It's about fact that ultimately this command is coming from an all-embracing creator who towers above creation, yet took the time to instruct the prophets of the creation for the children of man, all children of the Most High, do not commit premeditated murder. Verse 2, to make your ear attentive to wisdom if you incline your heart to discernment. So here, King David is telling us, according to Masudah David, that the way the Torah is communicated through prophetic teachings is to cause your ear intrinsically become attentive to wisdom and your heart now to develop a type of discernment that a person can develop a positive, intuitive type of reasoning, not just from the cognitive faculties of the brain, but the emotional plasticity of the heart. And this is, now I added some words here, but in general, this was a commentary from Masudah David. So, Dennis, these first two verses, a child of God, if we're a child of God, it's upon us to accept the instructions of the Creator. And it's not just a matter of getting our minds in tune, but getting our hearts in tune. Any take on these matters?
Well, our hearts and our minds are what we are made of. And that becomes our personality as a human. But we must remember there are do's and don'ts. And that's what our parents first taught us when we were little babies and growing up. And there's lines drawn in the sand that says, do not cross this line. And they may have a dozen things or reasons why you shouldn't cross the line. But humans have a funny way of approaching the line and coming up with excuses. Excuses sound good, gives you a reason to bypass the do not sign. Do not commit evil. Do not do bad. We approach those to see what happens if we nibble at it, if we take a little bite rather than make a whole meal out of it. We are inquisitive type of people who, once somebody says do not, we want to understand exactly what that not is. Is it evil? Is it bad? Sometimes we, being inquisitive, try to find out, and therefore we can come up with a new excuse. Wonderful. A new excuse to do things that we were told do not. But do not, sometimes people think, has the same effect when we're kids or as adults. They don't realize that those do nots are with us the whole life. So when someone says, do not murder, do not kill, do not do bad, do we take that seriously or do we treat it as a warning? If you step over the line, just like in traffic where there's cars, do not cross the line. Do not walk out into traffic. Are you going to test to see if you can get hit by a car? That doesn't make sense. Of course not. But we humans, when someone says, do not do something, all of a sudden we gravitate it. We think about it. And rather than think of the opposite as to why we do not, they think of the do not itself. Do not walk in traffic. That's stupid. But yet, when it comes to God, we sometimes will say, well, wait a minute. He really didn't mean this. He says it, but he doesn't have the conviction that I do. My convictions are stronger. Well, that's full of baloney. If you think your convictions are stronger than God, you are on the wrong planet. Anyway, we must remember that there's good and evil. It's your choice which one you want. If you tell little white lies because they're white, they're not lies, or there's no color to lies, baloney, you're looking for excuses. You either accept it or you don't. God will accept your choice even if you change your mind. He forgives everybody if you ask for it. So therefore, if you have the correct understanding, you can always go back to God. It's the worst scenario you could think of. God is there. He is waiting for us. We must not forget him. We must not avoid him. He is our life.
Amen. Thank you, Dennis. We're going to read now. We'll run through these five verses in chapter 2, verses 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and then we'll go into commentary, and then Dennis will have the last words in terms of these matters. So in chapter 2, verse 3, it says, "For if you call for understanding and raise your voice for discernment." Verse 4, "If you seek it like silver and hunt for it like treasures." Verse 5, "Then you will understand the fear of the Lord and you will find the knowledge of God." Verse 6, "For the Lord loves wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and discernment." 7, "He lays up sound wisdom for the upright and shield for those who walk in integrity." So calling out for understanding, meaning bringing other people into the discussion. It means discussing with other human beings, fellowshipping, I guess they call it in modern English. And when you're at the point of you want to seek discernment and understanding, seek it as silver. So seek it as a precious metal. That it is comparatively easy to acquire money by working and engaging in commerce. So one can acquire wisdom comparatively easily as well, because it's a commodity. But hunting it for like a treasure, one must toil by digging in the ground to find treasures. So one must toil to acquire discernment by delving deeply into the words of wisdom according to Malbim. In verse 6, the Lord gives wisdom. Have you learned that wisdom is great? For it was given from the mouth of the Holy One, blessed be He. Therefore, you must acquire it. If it's so wondrous to you, go ahead, make it your own. Make it a part and parcel of your consciousness, according to Rashi. He lays up wisdom for the upright. The Holy One, blessed be He, has stored up something so beautiful for the human family experience that it was written down. And this matter was written down is called the Torah. And according, you might say we're being culturally ethnocentric, but we're saying this is also a universal instruction, which is the essence of the world and its preservation, as well as the preservation of the soul hereafter. And with that being said, blessed souls, it's up to you to decide what is divine instruction. For me, as a Jew, it's the Torah. Maybe you're a Christian, it's the Old Testament, New Testament, or our Islamic compadres. It is the Quran. And I guess for someone who's a Hindu or whatever other faith-based belief systems are, that ultimately people are reaching out to things because it's beyond normal day-to-day mundane living. But I would advise that when we talk about beyond normative living experiences, profound experiences, that a spiritual high is not as potent as getting a spiritual high. And then seeing how can you increase in your acts of kindness and goodness and speaking process, because you're taking something way beyond yourself and now you're breaking it down that it should be made accessible to other people. So other people now should start their journey of seeking out the Creator. Dennis, I'll let you have the last word on this and then we're going to close out the show.
All right. Scripture, all scripture, said do's and don'ts. Now, in some cases, they give the word instruction. They're not instructing you to do bad things. They're instructions to stay away from bad and to do good things. But the real nub of your choice depends on if you do something good, do you feel good? If you do something bad, do you feel bad? Do you know the difference? Are you confused? Are you mixing them up? That's why we have instruction, education, knowledge, wisdom, so that we understand our choice. Our choice is something that we make, and it's very personal. You have the freedom to choose between good and evil at any time. You have the freedom to choose, well, I'll take some of the good and some of the evil. Are you kidding yourself? You can mix good and evil together? Doesn't make sense. That's like saying, let's have an argument without weapons. that means you can't escalate it to the point of doing harm to your neighbor or the person you're arguing with. How far can you go? You must be able to understand your choices. Instruction, education, knowledge, wisdom is all there to help you make the correct choice. It doesn't mean that it covers everything, but what you want to understand is your choice. If you can accept it, you can do it. But if you can't accept it, well, then you're laying yourself down by the wayside and watching the world go by. You can't do that. You must participate. We are not nature. We are humans. And that's the difference. We have to do something. You have to make choices. God is there to help you.
Thank you, Dennis. So I'd like to thank you for coming on today. I think it was a very edifying program. As you notice, I'm speaking a little bit slower because I think maybe sometimes in the heat of discussion, more likely to over-generate a type of feeling as opposed to just staying calm and let the receiver of these words decide for him or herself if they want to accept these words, learn more about it, or just turn the page and go on, you know, with their daily proceedings and seek other forms of stimulation through the act, the privileged act of a human being being able to communicate his or her words to other human beings. So with those, I'd like to thank Dennis Ryan again for coming on today's program. Unfortunately, I reached out to Rob Walker, our other co-host, a good dude from Brooklyn. He wasn't available today. Dennis, any last wisdoms you'd like to impart to our international audience?
Yes, I'd like to use an old Spanish expression, and it's called Vaya con Dios, go with God. We can do no worse than that.
Very good. So listen, I'd like to end, actually, you know, we sometimes like to end off with a musical segue of the program, but I would like to actually, it's about a minute, it's a 1 minute and 11 seconds. It was a speech recently given by New York City Honorable Mayor Eric Adams talking about the situation. And again, it's not only about, although, you know, it is an important component of, you know, the conflict between Israel and Hamas, but rather about just basic human decency and how even in conflict there have to be standards. And if all the standards go down, and standards in other areas of life can also descend, and as Lubavitch Rebbe was prone to say many times, this world is not a jungle. This earth, this blessed, is no different than it was before the original sin with Adam and Eve. It's still a garden. It just looks less of a garden because of the concrete cities and the industrial age, and now the information age, but it's still a garden where all human beings can enjoy, hopefully in a way of a havachad, one love, goralachad, one desk, kulano for always with dark narkasham. And here we're going to end off with the Honorable New York Adams talking about the need for decency. Take care, everyone.
Spoke for over an hour.